Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Tracy McClure with you over the next half hour. Coming up on today's broadcast, Jill Bevilacqua reflects on the Sunday Gospel reading in her series, There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye. And St. Francis in Music and Art, the saint from Assisi, an inspiration for composers and artists through the centuries. Well, as usual, we begin today with Sean Patrick Lovett, who introduces us to the Sunday Gospel reading in the program, There's More in the Sunday Gospel Than Meets the Eye. Let's listen.
Jesus said to his disciples, "If you can trust a man in little things, you can also trust him in greater. While anyone unjust in a slight matter is also unjust in greater. If you cannot be trusted with elusive wealth, who will trust you with lasting? And if you have not been trustworthy with someone else's money, who will give you what is your own? No servant can serve two masters. Either he will hate the one and love the other, or be attentive to the one and despise the other. You cannot give yourself to God and money."
From the parables of the merciful love of God, that of the lost sheep, the lost drachma, the prodigal son, Jesus passes on to parables on the use and misuse of riches. "What made him choose these particular themes?" queries Piero Bargellini. "Why so much insistence on the humble being exalted and the proud being humbled, the first being last and the last first?" "It was the condition of his listeners," explains the writer. "In particular, scribes and Pharisees, priests and doctors of the law. If the exalted had been worthy of being exalted, the prudent sheep better than the lost, the obedient sons more just than the prodigal, there would have been no need to address the subject. But those listeners who were also his enemies believed themselves superior to other men, sinners, tax collectors and the like, while guilty themselves of hypocrisy and greed. The Pharisees loved money." Luke doesn't mince his words. But to give them their due, there was more to it than that. A note by one biblical scholar reminds us.
"The Jews mistakenly thought that misfortunes were always God's punishment, and that wealth was always a sign of his blessing. The richer they were, the more righteous did they think themselves. This idea made them go to all lengths to ensure that this sign of divine protection, wealth, should never fail them."
After recounting the parable of the unjust steward, our Lord says something which has an echo of the parable of the talents. "If you can trust a man in little things, you can also trust him in greater." The man who entrusted his property to servants and received interest from those to whom he'd given 5 and 2 talents praised them, saying, "You have shown you can be faithful in small things. I will trust you with greater." It's interesting that the word faithful is used here in the sense of having proved worthy of trust. In the Gospel today, while the version we've heard and the Jerusalem Bible both use trust, "if you can trust a man and the man who can be trusted," the Revised Standard Version reads, "he who is faithful in a very little," and the Vulgate, "he that is faithful in that which is least." In the second, negative part of this opening statement, the Vulgate uses the word unjust, as today's version does, "he that is unjust in that which is little," whereas both the Jerusalem Bible and the Revised Standard Version have dishonest. I wonder which word comes closer to the original. Now we come to the thing itself, what is often jokingly called filthy lucre, a phrase which St. Paul used in all seriousness in his letter to Titus, warning him of those who are ruining whole families by teaching things that they ought not to, for filthy lucre's sake. Today it's rendered as with the vile motive of making money. In his first letter to Timothy, Paul states that a presiding elder must not be greedy of filthy lucre, in today's phrase, a lover of money. Originally, the word lucre had no negative undertones, meaning simply gain or profit. Only later it came to mean dishonourable gain. Today it's almost always used in jest, though the word lucrative can still be spoken without suggesting dishonest practice. But temptation hovers always in the wings, as when Samuel's sons, whom he had appointed judges, turned aside after lucre and took bribes. Money, as we call it today, has many names and has been given many labels. Money has no smell, we were told. Money talks, some said. And today everyone talks of money. But in my childhood, we were not allowed to talk about it. It was considered vulgar. In the Gospel version we heard today, it's called elusive wealth. The Jerusalem Bible calls it money, that tainted thing, while both the Vulgate and the Revised Standard Version use the old word mammon, the unjust, the unrighteous mammon. And in the final line, the celebrated phrase, you cannot serve God and mammon. Mammon is generally described as the god of this world. In Aramaic, mammona or mammon meant riches or gain. In Syriac, riches, while according to St. Augustine, it was Punic for greed. But for John Milton, writing in Paradise Lost, mammon was the personification of the evils of wealth and miserliness.
Mammon led them on. Mammon, the least erected spirit that fell from heaven. For even in heaven, his looks and thoughts were always downward bent, admiring more the riches of heaven's pavement, trodden gold, than aught divine or holy else enjoyed in vision beatific. By him first men also, and by his suggestion taught, ransacked the centre, and with impious hands rifled the bowels of their mother earth for treasures better hid. Soon had his crew opened into the hill a spacious wound, and digged out ribs of gold. Let none admire that riches grow in hell, that soil may best deserve the precious bane.
The evil of miserliness was depicted by Dickens in the person of Scrooge in his A Christmas Carol.
Oh, but he was a tight-fisted hand at the grindstone, Scrooge, a squeezing, wrenching, grasping, scraping, clutching, covetous old sinner, hard and sharp as flint, from which no steel had ever struck out generous fire, secret and self-contained and solitary as an oyster. The cold within him froze his old features, nipped his pointed nose, shriveled his cheek, stiffened his gait, made his eyes red, his lips thin, blue, and spoke out shrewdly in his grating voice. A frosty rime was on his head, and on his eyebrows, and his wiry chin. He carried his own low temperature always about with him. He iced his office in the dog days, and didn't thaw it one degree at Christmas.
One of the most quoted, or rather misquoted, phrases on the subject of money and evil is Paul's, usually rendered as, "Money is the root of all evil." There's even a song. But that was not what Paul said, or rather wrote, in that same letter to Timothy, where he called it filthy lucre.
People who are neither rational nor informed imagine that religion is a way of making a profit. Religion, of course, does bring large profits, but only to those who are content with what they have. We brought nothing into the world, and we can take nothing out of it. But as long as we have food and clothing, let us be content with that. People who long to be rich are a prey to temptation. They get trapped into all sorts of foolish and dangerous ambitions, which eventually plunge them into ruin and destruction. The love of money is the root of all evils, and there are some who, pursuing it, have wandered away from the faith, and so given their souls any number of fatal wounds.
The pursuit of money takes many forms, one of which is familiar to millions, the phenomenon of the gold rush. When gold was discovered in California in 1848, thousands of fortune seekers set out the following spring in covered wagons for the West. The 49ers, as they came to be known, travelled some 2,000 miles, and though cholera, starvation and Indian attacks reduced their number, by the end of the year, 80,000 people had made it to the Pacific coast. In his poem, The Spell of the Yukon, Canadian Robert Service reminds us of the movement in the opposite direction, the Klondike gold rush in the closing years of the century.
I wanted the gold, and I sought it. I scrabbled and mucked like a slave. Was it famine or scurvy, I fought it. I hurled my youth into the grave. I wanted the gold, and I got it. Came out with a fortune last fall. Yet somehow life's not what I thought it, and somehow the gold isn't all. There's gold, and it's haunting and haunting. It's luring me on as of old. Yet it isn't the gold that I'm wanting so much as just finding the gold.
That riches can be a hindrance to progress in the spiritual life was admitted by Francis Bacon, Lord Chancellor to King James I, but accused of taking bribes, fined and imprisoned. Though later pardoned, he took no further part in public life, devoting his remaining years to literature.
I cannot call riches better than the baggage of virtue. The Roman word is better, impedimenta, for as the baggage is to an army, so is riches to virtue. It cannot be spared, nor left behind, but it hindereth the march, yea, and the care of it sometimes loseth or disturbeth the victory.
Bacon was surely speaking from the heart. St. Paul told Timothy to warn the rich not to set their hopes on money, which is untrustworthy, but on God, who out of his riches gives us all that we need for our happiness. Tell them to be rich in good works, he said, generous and willing to share. This is the way they can save up a good capital sum for the future, if they want to make sure of the only life that is real. Of all the many things Jesus said about riches, the most celebrated is the reference to the camel and the eye of the needle. How hard it is for those who have riches to make their way into the kingdom of God, he said, looking at the rich young man as he turned sadly away. And a church father of the second century, Clement of Alexandria, wrote a homily on the theme, Who is the rich man that is saved? Comments William Jurgens in The Faith of the Early Fathers, apparently Clement had wealthy people among his charges, for he takes the consoling view that when the Lord said, Go sell whatever you have and give it to the poor, he didn't really mean anything quite that drastic. Professor Henry Chadwick, in his History of the Early Church, writes,
Clement wrote a special discourse to help Christians puzzled about the right use of their money and troubled especially by the absolute command of the Lord to the rich young ruler, If you would be perfect, sell all you have. On a rapid reading, it might seem as if Clement were merely a compromiser, trying to wriggle out of the plain meaning of a commandment. But a fairer reading of his tract shows that he did not see the gospel ethic as imposing legalistic obligations, but rather as a statement of God's higher purpose for those who follow him to the utmost. What really matters is the use rather than the accident of possession. Accordingly, Clement laid down a guide for the wealthy converts of the Alexandrian church.
And here now is Clement himself.
We must not cast away the wealth that benefits our neighbours also. This wealth is at our disposal and is supplied to us as a sort of material and as an instrument to be well used by those who know how to do so. Its nature is to serve and not to rule. Let no one therefore destroy his possessions, but rather the passions of his soul, which prevent his making a better use of his property, so that he may become noble and good and be able to use these possessions too in a noble manner. We must therefore interpret the abandoning of all a man has and selling all he has in this way as being spoken concerning the passions of the soul. He who considers possessions and gold and silver and houses as God's gifts and by using them to further men's salvation renders service also to God, who gave them and knows that he possesses these things more for his brethren's sake than his own, who is superior to his possession of them, not being a slave of what he possesses, who does not bear these things about in his soul, nor bound and circumscribe his own life to them. Who is able, if ever he must be deprived of these things, to endure the loss of them as contentedly as their superabundance. This is he who is called blessed by the Lord, and poor in spirit, ready to be an heir of the kingdom of heaven.
And let's end this serious and difficult subject with some reflections on a lighter note. Humorist Stephen Leacock's Summer Sorrows of the Super Rich.
In the course of each summer, it is my privilege to do some visiting in the class of the upper super-rich, people who have huge estates at fashionable places where the country is so beautifully wild that it costs $1,000 an acre. Now, you'd think that the people who live in these great places are happy. They're not. They have troubles of which you and I and the ordinary people never dream. They come out to the wilderness to rough it and to snatch a brief 4 months' vacation between the strain of the Riviera and the pressure of New York. And then, right in the happiest season of the summer, they come up against desperate problems. Problem number one. What to do to amuse the butler in the evening? It seems that he doesn't play bridge.
The butler who was here last year was always quite content if he could be provided with a game of bridge and a run to New York now and then and a trip to see his brother in Vancouver. But the new man, Jennings, says quite frankly that he doesn't mind cards in the house, but they simply don't interest him. So what can one do?
Problem number two, how to get the chauffeur's collars starched. It appears that there have been very great difficulties about this.
It's very hard to get the kind of gloss that Ransom likes on his collars. There is, of course, an electric laundry in the basement, but unfortunately the laundry maids who do the work in it will not undertake any collars over 11 inches long.
Problem number three, what to get the cook to read on Sunday?
The trouble is she doesn't care for fiction. She evidently is a woman of literary culture somehow, because she said one day that she'd read the whole of Shakespeare and thought it very good. In the library, of course, there are all the new books, because there's a standing order with Spentano to send up £50 of new fiction by express once a week. None of the guests of the house ever care to read any book more than 3 weeks old, as they're quite worthless for conversation. An order was sent to Boston for the Harvard Classics, but the cook says she doesn't care for the way they're selected. The only compromise so far is to get her books about the South Seas. But they'll only last her 7 weeks, and after that, we don't know what to do.
My visits with my fashionable friends have been so much disturbed by perpetual conversation on these problems that I've decided to give them up altogether and to get back into my own class of society. I have some friends, real ones, who have a wooden house on an island where there's no electric light within 20 miles and where they use rainwater out of a barrel.
Thanks there to Jill Bevilacqua for that program. Francis in Assisi again, Tuesday, September 20th, for a meeting of interfaith leaders united in prayers for peace. Remember, Jorge Bergoglio took his name as Pope from the saint of Assisi, whose work for peace and love of the poor and creation bear the hallmark of this papacy. But as Monsignor Philip Whitmore tells us, composers like Liszt and Messier also found inspiration in St. Francis.
We've just been listening to a modern opera by the great French composer Olivier Messiaen. It was written in 1983, when the composer was 75 years old. Messiaen was a man of deep faith, and it came as no surprise that he chose a religious subject for this, his first and only opera. It's about St. Francis of Assisi. That was St. Francis himself, leading the friars in morning prayer. He's singing a passage from one of his most famous prayers, the Canticle of the Sun.
All praise be yours, my Lord, through all that you have made, and first my Lord, brother Sun, who brings the day, through whom you give us light. All praise be yours, my Lord, through sister Moon and stars. In the heavens you have made them bright, precious and fair. All praise be yours, my Lord, through brothers wind and air, both fair and stormy, all the weather's moods, by which you cherish all that you have made. All praise be yours, my Lord, through Sister Water, so useful, humble, precious, and pure.
St. Francis's love of creatures, especially animals, has inspired many artists and musicians over the centuries. Some of you may know the lovely fresco by Giotto of St. Francis feeding the birds. Rather less well known is a short piano piece by the 19th century Hungarian composer Franz Liszt. It paints a picture in sound of St. Francis preaching to the birds. As you can hear, the birds are still quite excited at this point, but later in the piece they calm down and pay a bit more attention to the saintly preacher. St. Francis has inspired hymn writers too. His Canticle of the Sun is the basis of a popular hymn. All creatures of our God and King, lift up your voice and with us sing, O praise him, Alleluia. The tune is a German chorale, Lasst uns erfreuen, written in Cologne early in the 17th century. The original words were addressed to Our Lady, rejoicing that her sorrows had been banished by the resurrection of her Son. That's why there are so many Alleluias. The tune has spread to many different countries, and new texts have been supplied not only in English, but in Italian, in Portuguese, and in other languages too. It was a truly inspired choice by the country clergyman William Draper to make an adaptation of St. Francis's Canticle of the Sun to be sung to this tune. Those ringing Alleluias perfectly match the joyful spirit of praise pouring forth from sun and stars, earth and seas, and from every creature of our God and King.
Monsignor Philip Whitmore is a music historian and currently the rector of the venerable English College in Rome. Well, as we find out now, St. Francis also inspired artworks like the one we're about to hear about. This painting is in an unexpected place, the Mother Church of the Jesuits here in Rome, Il Gesù. Veronica Scarisbrick went exploring with fine arts professor Brita Ennis to rediscover an oil painting of St. Francis and the birds in a side chapel there.
Brita, we're going to do something strange today because this is the very place where St. Ignatius of Loyola, the founder of the Jesuits, is buried. Yet, to the right-hand side of the main altar, there's a little chapel which is dedicated to St. Francis. Now, today the Franciscans and the Jesuits do get along, but in the old days they were great rivals, weren't they?
Yes, but I mean, maybe it's almost the opposite, I don't know. various ways of interpreting this, because essentially St. Ignatius Loyola wanted to emulate St. Francis, living simply with very clear rules and regulations, etc., which he obviously did. He brought these rules and regulations also to a much more intellectual, sophisticated level, never losing simplicity and the sense of poverty that the Franciscans had. Now, if you look at the Jesuit Church, there's a very big iconographical plan laid out by the Jesuits for the Church. But what seems to slip out are these two little, tiny little sort of circular chapels, each side of the main altar, which seem to be tucked away. And they seem like little secret chapels. In a way, they represent the secret heart of Ignatius as a man and his personal veneration for St. Francis. So I always see these two little chapels as his heart and his little personal diary, whereas the rest of the Jesuit Church are his armour, and never forgetting either that the Jesuits are evangelical soldiers.
That's far too many ideas, Breda. Now we want to see the picture of St. Francis with the most beautiful birds in the world. What strikes you is obviously St. Francis in his brown habit with, bare hands, bare feet, and one can see there's a bit of light on his face. And behind him, two capuchins, a big tree, lilacs or an oak tree. Yeah. And then to the left of the picture is the most fascinating part, just the green landscape with all the soldier birds flying towards St. Francis.
This is the most fascinating painting I have ever seen relating to birds. An oil painting done by a Northern European painter.
Back to when, do you?
Yeah, in the 1600s. So you have St. Francis, simply dressed in his robes, bending slightly forward and talking with one of his hands out towards the birds. He's giving them instructions and preaching to them. All the birds are standing to attention. And even the ones in flight are concentrating all their energy on St. Francis. And the perfection of the way of painting these birds is such that the artist was able to capture the sense of their paying attention to what Francis was saying. It's not just a painting with birds nicely painted, etc., etc., but they're all standing to attention like soldiers and listening to their general. There's something extraordinarily beautiful about this painting. I mean, every time I see it, I get struck by the dynamic linear factor here. You have all these birds of different colours, different sizes, different types, but they're all have their beaks pointed towards the hand of St. Francis or towards his face. So it's the total concentration on what he's saying and his total involvement with them as well. So this lovely blending of nature and man and spiritual and God all together.
I don't know, it electrifies me every time I see that.
You can see the tension in their standing and paying attention, and they're strong and almost human in their way of posing and listening. It's very electrifying. And the fact that they're all lined up side by side, and some in front, some in the back, and then others coming down out of the sky, and others coming from outside the painting. So the whole thing lends to a massive sense of energy and power.
Breda Ennis, a professor of fine arts at the American University here in Rome, with Veronica Scarsbrick. And on that note, we've come to the end of today's broadcast. Thanks for joining me. I'm Tracy McClure. Laudato Jesus Christus.